Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye on 94.7 The Pulse.
Very good morning to James Taylor, senior journalist at the Surf Coast Times newspaper. How are you, James?
Good morning, Mitchell. How are you finding Anglesey?
Very good. A couple of showers coming through every now and again, but it's actually pretty sunny compared to yesterday. But one of the things that surprised me, because where we are looks over the Great Ocean Road here at the General Store, is just the number of tour buses. I didn't really realise that it was this prevalent, but we've just had bus after bus after bus, all full of people heading down to the coast.
Yeah, as I understand, Anglesey is one of the first places that that the tour companies like to sort of schedule a stop. I think the Shire has put in a couple of long bus parks just for that purpose. And I think there was a worry that the buses couldn't really find somewhere they could park a bus of like 16 metres or more in the town and sort of not become a traffic hazard. So I think they've put in some longer bus car parking down by the river so that all the buses can pull over safely and the tourists can get out and have a look at the river and maybe have a go on that fantastic little playground they've got just next to the beach down towards the curve at the Kingshead Curve is it something to do with a king on that corner where it turns around and goes uphill.
It's certainly one of the
major tourist stops along the Great Ocean Road there now.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting out and having a bit of a look around once I get off air, because I haven't actually been down to Anglesey for a little while. It's amazing how you don't sort of look around your own backyard sometimes.
That's right. I try very hard not to be blasé about the fact that I happen to work at the start of the Great Ocean Road, and my job often takes me driving down it. So what I do mention this to people who aren't necessarily from Victoria or from Australia, they go, "Oh, the Great Ocean Road, I've heard of that." But yeah, I see it every day. I drive in it probably at least once a day, if not more often.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, I was talking to the Mayor, Brian McKittrick, this morning, and also I was reading that great article in your newspaper. It was actually the Mayor's column, where he spoke about catching up with Darren Chester, who is the Federal Minister for Transport, just about the infrastructure on the Great Ocean Road, and this has become quite a political issue in recent times. What do you think are the main issues? I mean, you've spoken about bus parking there, but Brian McKittrick also raised that not enough toilets, and I know Sarah Henderson has talked about that as well in the past.
That's one of her big things, it's the small and the basic stuff, and you and I have spoken before about the need for there to be some serious investment going into sort of the other end of the Great Ocean Road at the 12 Apostles down that way, so that all the tourists have somewhere to go and somewhere to spend all their money once they get down the length of the Great Ocean Road. But I guess it's making it as friendly as easy to use as possible, so catering for the growing number of people, especially from the Chinese market, the overseas market, who are not jumping on tour buses, but instead hiring cars and driving down that way. And so to make it as easy as possible for them, so to pull over wherever it seems obvious and where is most likely and most sensible them to pull over and have a break and visit the toilet and all that sort of stuff. So it's the sort of thing. I guess it's the raising of expectations. But this is something I think that has been reported on before by Great Ocean Road Regional Tourism in terms of what people expect when they come to a major international tourist destination such as the Great Ocean Road, and what they're actually getting aren't exactly marrying up at this point. So I think there needs to be a bit of investment in that sense, just to raise the bar, so that when people drive down the Great Ocean Road, they are driving away thinking, "Well, that was a nice bit of road, but that's about it."
Yeah. Now, I was talking to the mayor about the rainbow flag situation,
of course,
it seems like there has been a resolution on that, in that a motion that I believe was raised by him, but you can correct me because I believe you were probably there.
I was.
He raised this motion, which was a compromise, and it was finally passed unanimously. And to be honest, just looking at Brian and his body language, it was just a sense of relief that this has been off the agenda, because I think he got the sense that this was really distracting from all of the things that he's trying to get done as mayor, and obviously the Shire is trying to do in areas of local government. And as I think I've said to you many times over, the more we talk about a flag, it takes away from talking about roads, rates, rubbish, aquatic centres, whatever, indoor stadiums.
You wouldn't want to go as far as saying it entirely derailed the council's agenda for those past 40 or so days that the flag went up, but it certainly put a dent in whatever they happened to do. It certainly dominated the discussion in the newsroom here. And one of those things, is that flags thing still going? But yes, it was unusual to see Brian himself pass the motion. He, as the mayor, he is usually the chair of the council meetings. They're held there in the council chambers or wherever the council might want to hold a meeting. But for this particular motion, which he described as a compromise, or a way to clean the slate and a way for everyone to move forward. He vacated the chair to Deputy Mayor Carol McGregor so that he could move the motion himself and lead discussion on it, which is very unusual. It's the first time I've seen it in my time covering local government. The first time I've seen a mayor do that, which I guess illustrates the feeling on the issue. And he implored his fellow councillors to pass the motion so that everyone could have something they were not necessarily entirely satisfied with, but something they could live with, and we could move forward. And I think the crowd really appreciated that. It was a larger than expected crowd at the Surf Coast Shire meeting. They actually hired a couple of security guards just in case, and it turned out to be entirely unneeded, as the crowd was very respectful and sat there and didn't jeer or boo or interrupt the councillors at any point. So I think the motion that was put forward was one of those motions that was generally agreed upon by pretty much all the councillors beforehand, and they went through the formalities of voting on it and then passing it unanimously. So it's something I think the council and hopefully the community is happy with, and it ends up being, well, they're going to build two new flagpoles, and one of the new flagpoles is going to have the rainbow flag on it. And whether that rainbow flag flies for all time or until marriage equality actually becomes a reality in this country, I don't know. That's probably going to be subject to a future council resolution, as the flag will stay up until the council specifically decides to pull it down. But given the flagpole that it will be flying on is in fact lower than the Australian flag, which I think became a key point of contention for some of the people who were objecting to it in the first place. That might be a solution that people in the Surf Coast community can actually live with.
I'm reticent to bring this up, but the whole point about having the flag up until same-sex marriage is legalised, I think, implies that once same-sex marriage is legalised, all of the issues currently being experienced by the LGBTQIA community will be resolved. But I've got a feeling that the flag might stay up after that, because I'm sure people will be lobbying for other things, and the issues won't just automatically fix themselves just because we've legalised same-sex marriage. So surely the flag would need to stay up, because otherwise it says, you know, that this whole thing has just been resolved by changing same-sex marriage, while there's a whole range of other issues as well.
Well, that's right. As I say, this sort of stuff is subject to council motions, and councillors, I guess, respond to the views of their community. So whether the community will, once, when and if marriage equality becomes a thing, whether the community looks at the flag and said, well, I think the flag serves its purpose, let's pull it down, or now that same-sex marriage is a thing, let's keep it up for a month and show that we've actually won, and we can celebrate the situation. Who knows? That's a bit of a hypothetical, really. I guess we'll have to wait to see what the community thinks about that.
And some people might blame the media for focusing too much on this issue, where, on the other hand, you've got a range of issues like the indoor stadium and all that, and we'll chat about that briefly in a second. But do you think that that's just the media responding to genuine public interest, or is it the media being a bit salacious and a bit opportunistic about this story?
Yeah, my position on the issue, if anyone wants to ask me, is that I know you could make the case that the media has sort of jumped on this as a hot topic and something that's going to drive readership and drive people picking up our newspapers and turning on our TV sets and getting hold of the news, and I guess you could level that criticism at the Circo Science for putting the picture of the pro flag rally on our 29 June editions when there are about 40 people there dressed in their rainbow colours under the flag making very loud noises in support of marriage equality. And my position is that if there's rallies against same-sex marriage, then I'll cover those too, as long as someone tells me about them and I can turn up and take pictures. So I guess I can only cover the things that happen right in front of me and the things that people tell me about, the things I find out about. So if there's vocal opposition that's somehow expressing itself out there in the community, then it's not making itself known to the local media.
Yeah, very well said. I couldn't agree more. One of the big issues as well has been the indoor stadium, and we've been speaking about this before, but the council has actually said we want $3 million, and Brian was saying this morning that I think the total cost is just somewhere in the realm of $13 million, so $3 million will be a small slice of that.
That's right. I think total cost is $13.5 million, and the Shire will put in about 10 of that, $2.9 million in developer contributions, and I think no more than $7.6 million from the council itself. I think the council is prepared to borrow to actually make up that $7.6 million figure, but $10 million from the council and $3 million from the state government, and that's $13.5 million for the stadium. I guess it's one of those things that these larger infrastructure projects really do depend on co-investment from either state and or federal government to sort of get them off the ground. I mean, $13 million in one hit is a lot of money. I mean, even $10 million in one hit is a lot of money. So the council was always going to have to defray the cost somehow by getting several million dollars from some high level government to make it happen. I guess the council will be making its application if it hasn't done so already, and will be crossing its fingers that it gets good news in November.
Now, I'd be interested in your thoughts on what's been happening in federal politics, because Christopher Pyne obviously was taped making that speech.
Speaking of same-sex marriage,
yeah.
That covered up in the whole can of worms, didn't
exactly.
It?
Well, he was making that speech to his moderate people at the federal Liberal conference, and
with a slightly hilarious group name of the Black Hand.
I know,
that's some sort of joke.
Yeah, exactly. Well, most groups like that have some sort of satirical name when they're underhand, like they call themselves the Resistance and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
But obviously it got leaked, and you can talk about the ethics of whether something's off the record or whatever, but now it's in the public domain. One of the things that I think is interesting is that I saw on Sky News, apparently someone, journalist, got a tip-off that Christopher Pyne had been ringing around all of the marginal seat MPs saying, I'm sorry for the distraction that this caused to the issues that you're campaigning for. And I have to assume that Sarah Henderson would have been one of the people that he called.
That's right. I mean, Corangamite is not the most marginal seat in Australia anymore, but it's probably in the top 20. I think the margin is 3%, 4%. It isn't very much. So I think we can probably safely assume that that Christopher called Sarah, and I haven't been gutsy enough to ask Sarah if Christopher called her, but let's assume that he did, because he would have called everybody. But yeah, it's interesting. I've mentioned this before. There's never been a more interesting time to be a former Prime Minister. Not only do they see that Julia Gillard has sort of made her debut as chair of Beyond Blue, we see Tony Abbott sort of popping out of the woodwork and pretending that he was never deposed as leader of the Liberal Party, and he's still acting like Prime Minister and submitting some Trump-ish policies with the serial numbers filed off. It is one of those things. It is getting to the point where you kind of look at what Tony Abbott is trying to do, and you start scratching your head and you think, well, what is he trying to do? Surely he can't think that he's a live prospect in the same way that Kevin Rudd was as leader in exile to become back and be leader of the parliamentary party again and end up being prime minister. Surely he doesn't think that's going to happen. And you have to start speculating, well, in that case, what is he trying to do? Is his only goal to muddy the waters every single time so that Malcolm Turnbull doesn't have a clear run at it and ends up sabotaging the party from the inside? I'm still trying to work it out.
One of the things, and you're right about Julia Gillard, she made her comeback on Late Line last night, and guess what? Yeah. I'll be trying to get her on the program because we spoke to Jeff
Absolutely.
Kennett.
Give her a call.
We spoke to Jeff Kennett when he was the leader of Beyond Blue, so I don't see why we wouldn't be able to get the former Prime Minister on. But one of the things I think is interesting is that the sort of conflict now between Turnbull and Abbott is so much more overt than back when it was Rudd and Gillard, maybe because Rudd was in the cabinet, or maybe now people are sort of wise to the destabilisation that goes on because we saw what happened in the Labour Party. But do you think it's so much more obvious now to everyone, the undermining that's going on?
Yeah, I think from what I've been reading from the various commentators who are on Twitter, especially on the conservative side of things, it's not so much about the leadership of the party as it is about the ideological basis of the party. Tony Abbott, for whatever reason, thinks that the Liberal Party isn't sufficiently right-wing enough, and it's hemorrhaging voters, I think, which is quite recent.
Yes, correct.
In a recent Mirror article. And so the party needs to stop pandering to the middle and pandering to the left, and stuff. It needs to start swinging right to keep stop defections, such as the case of Corey Bernardi, who has taken his bat, taken his ball, and started his own new party. So whether that's going to work, I don't know. But yeah, it's a much more vicious fight in that sense, I guess, because it's not about who wants to be leader. It's about, well, what does the party in fact stand for?
Well, we're almost out of time. Do you want to give us a quick local news tip or something that's going to be in the Surf Coast Times this week to leave us with?
Yeah, speaking of Surf Coast Shire Matters, they have other things that got passed at the council meeting other than the same-sex marriage stuff was the final version of their budget for this financial year. And some good news for the Surf Life Saving Clubs down this way, who are both the Janjuk and the Anglesey Surf Life Saving Clubs getting $250,000 each towards their proposed upgrades. The Janjak Surf Life Saving Club, I've spoken about before. They obviously got some good news from both the state and federal government in recent times, but now the Surf Coast Shire is chipping in with a little bit, so that'll probably be welcome as well.
Good to finish with some good news, James. Thank you very much, and we'll catch up in a fortnight, either in person or on the phone, depending on where we end up being, but thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Mitchell.
Thank you, James Taylor, their senior journalist at the Surf Coast Times newspaper.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.